internet is part of everyone's life, but people in rural areas usually get it at much slower speeds. Here's the FCC's Ajit Pai speaking to the Washington Post in 2015.
If you're talking about a rural telephone company that's trying to deploy fiber to counties with less than one person per square mile, you don't have to be an economist to know that the return on that investment is going to be negligible, probably negative.
Plus, how do you lower infant mortality? Some health workers in Chicago are trying out a survey with much bigger questions to try to understand the problem.
What we're hoping to discover is issues that are truly impacting the health that are not being collected and that the doctors cannot see when they come and see the woman and prescribe her one pill.
And a ProPublica Illinois investigation shows that a so-called independent watchdog is being funded by right-leaning political groups. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. We'll get started just after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. 14 years ago, President George W. Bush said he wanted our entire country to be connected to the internet by 2007. Today, nearly all Americans have internet access, but almost 40% of people who live in rural areas don't have access to broadband. There also aren't very many choices, meaning that residents pay a lot for lower quality service. The last three administrations have all said that this is a priority, including the current one. This month, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai proposed $500 million towards developing better rural broadband access. We wanted to get a sense of what this looks like in Illinois. In our state house, three state senators are working on a bipartisan bill that's trying to increase access to high-speed internet in rural school districts. I'm joined now by one of those lawmakers. Senator Sam McCann is a Republican. He represents Illinois' 50th district, which stretches from the area just west of Springfield all the way to the Missouri border, just north of St. Louis. He's online with us now. Senator McCann, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Senator, well, thank you, Nyla. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Good morning. So you've been working on this bill with Senator Andy Menar, Jennifer Bertino, I believe, correct? What's the goal of what you all are trying to do?
Well, I think primarily the primary focus of the bill is to bring broadband high-speed internet access to every school district in the state. There's about 100 school districts in the state, approximately an eighth of the school districts around the state who don't have access to that. Approximately 10 of those 100 are in the 50th district, which is nine counties in central and west central Illinois. And, you know, the four corners of my district are Springfield, basically Quincy, basically St. Louis, and Carlinville. And in the four corners, high-speed internet isn't such an issue to attain. You might have to pay for it, but you can get it. And actually, the market is making it accessible. But inside that the inner part of that district, the rural areas, as you said in your intro, you know, it's either high-speed either isn't available or there's only one option, like, say, satellite, which is very expensive and very undependable.
And so your proposal would set aside more than $16 million in the upcoming state budget to help schools. How would this work in terms of providing better access?
Well, first of all, it comes from the School Infrastructure Fund. The governor's budget book estimated that there would be approximately $160 million as a fund balance at the end of fiscal year 2018. So there's plenty of money in there. We're only talking about taking about 10% of what the governor himself has projected the balance to be. And the wonderful news is that we can use that $16 million to leverage about $50 million from the federal government that will go away, that we will lose an opportunity to leverage in matching funds if we don't get it done within the next year or so. The federal government will spend those dollars regardless. They will send them to a state or a set of school districts somewhere in the nation who has their act together and their financing together. And so what we're proposing is we have a dedicated fund. This is not general revenue. These are dedicated funds, and it comes from an excise tax on telecommunications already. That being said, We want to leverage those federal dollars and use them to get high-speed internet to the school districts. And I think once we get high-speed internet to the school districts, you'll see the ability for other entities within communities to take advantage of that high-speed internet. You'll see businesses and families who need it. I mean, really, it is a part of 21st century life. It's not a luxury. This is what it takes to be successful in the 21st century in just about any industry, just about any undertaking one might have.
And Senator McCann, I think working on increasing broadband access to schools seems like something most Republicans and Democrats can agree on. Is it your goal to also work on bipartisan efforts to expand broadband access beyond schools?
It is. I've actually been working on that for the better part of a year. I had a bill in last winter that I'm going to continue. I wasn't able to get out of committee, but I'm working on. Part of it is truth in advertising. You know, one of the biggest problems that we have is we have rural, not all are doing this, but many of the rural telephone carriers who offer DSL, you know, many times they say speeds up to, and the up to part is in very small font, and then the 10 meg or 20 meg or 50 meg or whatever number they're using is in very large font, and then there's an asterisk behind it. And, you know, it leads people to believe that if they part with $100 or $150 this month, that they will have high-speed internet, and then once they get it, they're lucky to get a half a meg or even 1 meg of download speed. And so that's a real issue. I liken it to, you know, it's kind of like the telephone in the previous century. So in 1950, if you applied for a job and you said to your employer, I don't have a telephone, but I can give you my neighbor's telephone number, you know, that sort of worked. By the end of that century, that didn't really work. People expected you to have a telephone. They expected you, for the most part, to have a cell phone. They expected you to have a working email. And so here we are in 2018, and if you're going to succeed, if you're going to take online classes, if you're going to teach online classes, if you're going to transact e-commerce, if you're going to succeed in the 21st century, you have to have access to high-speed internet.
Senator McCann, I think many might look at the Republican Party and the Trump administration and feel like orders that roll back net neutrality regulations might make it even harder for rural areas. And I'm thinking about in Montana, the Democratic governor there, for example, signed an order that said that ISP internet service providers with state contracts can't charge more for faster speeds. And I wonder, with this proposal that you're working on, even with this proposal you're working on for rural school districts, are you concerned that this could be an uphill battle if internet service providers start charging more to consumers?
Well, definitely. I definitely am. I'm not sure that I agree with the net neutrality issue the way it's moved forward. I guess we'll see what happens. I mean, we're being promised that it won't have the effect that you're describing, and since it's now, that's the way the direction we're moving forward. I, like many others, am hoping that what we're being told is going to happen by the federal government is what happens. In other words, we won't have those metering and dial downs and dial backs. I guess time will tell. But again, I'm not a prognosticator. I'm just like everybody else. I have no ability to see exactly what the future is going to hold. I can use common sense and education and knowledge to try to predict and try to work for better. So I don't necessarily agree with the administration's take on net neutrality, but that's the direction that they chose to go, and we'll see how it goes. We'll keep an eye on it. We'll monitor it. And if it indeed does start causing problems with access, because again, I have an interesting district in that it contains the city of Springfield, it contains the west side of Springfield, it contains all nine counties have a rural component. I go into the metro east of St. Louis. So it's an interesting district, and it's kind of a microcosm of the state, and the state is a microcosm of the nation. It's a very diverse district. It's a very diverse state, and I think that diversity, quite frankly, is our strength. It's not something we should be ashamed of and run from. It's something we should embrace and utilize and leverage, but we want to keep an eye on this, and we want to make sure that everybody is treated equally. You know, we can't guarantee equal results, but we can guarantee equal access.
That's State Senator Sam McCann explaining a proposal he's working on with his Democratic colleagues in the State House to increase access to high-speed internet in rural school districts. We'll keep an eye on how this proceeds in the legislature. Senator McCann, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Nyla, thank you. You do a great job. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm joined now by Erica Hunsinger. She's the editor of Harvest Public Media. That's a collaboration focused on food, agriculture, and other rural issues. She's been reporting on this issue of rural broadband. She joins me now from KCUR in Kansas City. Hi, Erica. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
So when we're thinking about, I wonder if we should just walk back a second.
Sure.
Senator McCann was talking about the speeds, and I think that's important. When we're talking about the digital divide between urban areas and rural areas, what does this actually look like in terms of options for consumers? And I think maybe people maybe just see maybe one company or two companies. I know, for example, here in Champaign-Urbana, I've been researching this because I've been trying to figure out how to get rid of my cable, and I know there's only two options in Champaign-Urbana. You have Comcast or AT&T, and I imagine that's true for most of the state.
I would believe so. I mean, I think the key here with rural areas is that you usually only have one provider, and it's your one rural area. I was speaking with Shirley Bloomfield, who runs the Rural Broadband Association, last week, and she kind of made a point that I think is an interesting one, in that, you know, people will talk about they want competition, kind of like you said, you know, not really sure who to go to for my internet services, but I only really have two choices. And what she was trying to explain is that competition in rural areas is difficult because it's already a market that's pretty expensive. You know, the density, the number of people per square mile is so low that already it's really expensive to get, you know, fiber connections out there. So if you're in a market where there's not that many people and trying to introduce competition otherwise is going to make it more expensive. And so she was just kind of, you know, letting people think about that competition, while it sounds good, isn't really necessarily a good thing for the rural areas.
And let's talk about the role then of federal dollars in all of this. Senator McCann was talking about the initiative here, which would take advantage of some matching federal funds for schools. As I mentioned earlier, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai wants $500 million to go to rural broadband, although some experts have said that's essentially just restoring funding that was previously cut. I wonder, do the people you've talked to in your reporting believe there's enough money going to this issue?
Not at all. I've, you know, aside from Shirley with the NTCA, I've also talked to someone who runs a rural telecom company in Kansas, kind of northeast Kansas. Both of them said this is so expensive that just the $500 million, which both of them said is just kind of restoring cuts, isn't going to help. You know, Shirley didn't want to really get into too many estimates, but the way that she explained it is that it could be, you know, close to like $1 billion for this to really work the way it is. So, you know, $500 million is coming through the Universal Service Fund that was started back when we had telephones, like Senator McCann was saying. And it was a way to make sure that people all over the country had access to this kind of stuff. So the money is coming from them. But Jason Smith at Rainbow Communications in Kansas basically said they've been cutting a lot of that funding. You know, they're looking at a funding shortfall. I think last year they said it was about $160 million a year for just one part of this universal service funding. And he's at the point where his company has a 15% of that federal money being cut. So it's difficult for rural telecommunications companies to actually budget going forward. So, you know, it clearly needs more funding. You've got a bipartisan group of senators in Congress who have asked Trump to look at perhaps making rural broadband and the funding of it a standalone issue as part of an infrastructure package instead of, you know, kind of running it through the USDA.
And so I guess the question is, who is funding all of this? Are telecommunications companies? It sounds like the biggest problem is that telecommunications companies don't want to put the money into, or don't see the business advantage of putting money into investing in this from a rural perspective.
I don't necessarily think that's true. I think what they – so the telecommunications places in Kansas, they did a lot of the – they did all the upfront funding for their projects because they've got fiber optic in 500 square miles, and it's about – serves about 1,500 people. So they say that they have 100% of people, you know, who are on board, but they paid for it up front. And so the federal money that they're getting is kind of, in essence, a subsidy to help them pay for what they put up front. There's also a separate version that, you know, it's numbers are difficult for me sometimes. But, you know, I think the key is people do want to be able to fund it. But even though you get the fiber optics out there, you get broadband out there, it's not just a matter of having it there. Then you also have to upgrade it constantly. And especially when you have more demand coming in rural areas, a lot of the agriculture now is starting to use a lot of data. And so you have more demand. And so keeping up with that demand can be difficult for rural communications places if they don't have the money coming in.
Erica Hunsinger is an editor with Parvis Public Media. That's a collaboration that's based on a news collaboration based on food, agriculture, other rural issues. Joining us from KCUR in Kansas City. We'll tweet out Erica's story that she just did about this issue. Erica, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Nyla.
Coming up, we're going to be taking a look at a unique infant mortality prevention program in Chicago that's drawing on resources from Cuba. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. Infant mortality is typically a metric you hear about with developing countries. So when it comes to infant mortality, you probably think that our country, being one of the wealthiest in the world, is doing really well. But it depends on where you live. Here in Illinois, we're right above the national average with 6 deaths per 1,000 live births. That's 2015 numbers. But in some neighborhoods, those numbers skyrocket. On the south side of Chicago, for example, 14.5 babies per 1,000 do not make it through their first year. That rate is almost the same as Syria. That's according to a WBEZ story that just came out looking at infant mortality in Chicago. We'll tweet out a link to that. WBEZ Chicago Public Media inspired us to look at what infant mortality rates look like throughout Illinois and see what public health workers are doing to try to improve that. We're joined now by epidemiologist Dr. Kathy Tosis-Milligan, who was featured in that BEZ story. She's been researching infant mortality on Chicago's South Side. She's an epidemiologist with University of Illinois at Chicago. Andrea Palmer is also with us. She's chief of the Maternal and Child Health Division's Services at the Illinois Department of Public Health. Also with us is Dr. Bo Batten, who teaches at SIU School of Medicine and also directs newborn services at St. John's Hospital in Springfield. All of you, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having us.
Hi. Pleasure to be here.
Dr. Tosis-Milligan, let's start with you. I mentioned infant mortality rates on the south side of Chicago, and I just wanted to ask you a little bit more about that number. Who's being affected the most?
Well, I think like many of the disparities that impact our community, unfortunately, women of color, particularly African-American women, are impacted the most by the statistics. So it is really Black babies that are dying most often.
And when you're trying to solve a problem like this, I imagine it feels natural to look around and see if there are models in other parts of the country where different urban areas or rural areas are looking at improving infant mortality rates. Did you find any places that are doing that?
Right. So, I mean, so the whole concept around partnering with Cuba, which is what we're going to get into in a little bit, is that, you know, we started looking locally and really looking for places where there were underserved neighborhoods or, you know, poor neighborhoods that had remarkable infant mortality rates, and we weren't able to find it. And we looked locally, we looked at the state level, we looked at the U.S. level, and we didn't find any. So we started looking internationally. And there were a couple of countries that we, you know, looked at, Chile being one, China, Colombia, all countries that have much lower GDPs than the United States, that spend much less money per capita, that have similar life expectancy, and some of them had lower infant mortality rates. But, you know, remarkably, of course, Cuba came as the top with the lowest infant mortality rate of all those countries, and then became a target for us to look at what they were doing that we could model.
And so that led to an unusual and a rare partnership with the Cuban Ministry of Health, the Cuban Ministry of Public Health, between the Cuban Ministry of Public Health and UIC's Cancer Center. How did that come about? What kind of tools are you all using now?
So the partnership came about in a really wonderful way. This was probably back in 2013, 2014, when our Cancer Center Director and Associate Vice Chancellor for Community-Based Practices at the University of Illinois at Chicago, Dr. Robert Wynn, traveled to Cuba for the first time to present at a conference that they hold every few years. That's called Cuba Salud. In fact, it's happening this year in April again. And there he met a few people actually from here, from the states, as well as representatives from the Ministry of Health. And you know, he learned about the remarkable primary health care system. And they started brainstorming and came about with this idea of developing a partnership, whether and infant mortality was one of the things that they were open, of course, to discussing around just the remarkable improvement that they've made since the revolution. And so they came back, and Dr. Wynn and my colleague, Dr. Kareem Watson at the University of Illinois Cancer Center, drafted a grant that was actually put through through the Kellogg Foundation, who was, you know, the of course, very enterprising and forward-thinking of them to be able to fund this project, to develop a partnership, to develop a partnership-building grant, which is also very unusual. And the goal of the grant was truly whether or not we could partner with Cuba to exchange best practices. And so the development of the idea around infant mortality came later when they had their first historic visit, which happened actually January of 2017, in fact. And they started talking about their system. And during that conversation, they mentioned this tool that they use that is a health situation analysis, is the best translation that we could come up with, which is really a tool that is used at the primary care setting for each doctor that they have in the neighborhood to perform at the homes of each of the about 140 to 160 families that they provide care for. And it's a comprehensive tool that talks, you know, asks about the environment, the built environment, the health, the risk factors of each of those individuals in each of those families. And that data is aggregated, it is summarized, it is risk stratified, and based on that, they make decisions about what are the needs of their particular communities. This tool is used yearly at their primary care setting, and they have shown remarkable, of course, improvements in their primary care with this particular tool. One of those examples is, of course, in the realm of infant mortality.
And so what kind of questions are you asking women? Because I think you're asking women questions that we wouldn't think would be related to infant mortality, like how their teeth, their dental health is.
Yeah. So, you know, what we did, and by the way, the Cuban experts will tell you that this health situation analysis tool is not a tool that they invented. This tool, in fact, is recommended by the World Health Organization. It's the way in which they use the tool that I think is so remarkable. And so, you know, it's a number of concepts that they then expand, and we expand into questions based on the relevance of your territory. So, for example, in their country, they would ask questions around where your water is sourced from, whether it comes from a well or from, you know, a plant or whatever. And, of course, that would not apply here. But, yeah, so it's very comprehensive. Some of the questions that we asked, as you mentioned, were questions around your dental care. Why dental care? Because dental care relates to, you know, could be around sepsis, for example, and having it's somehow related to inflammatory responses that could lead to premature birth. That could also then contribute to, of course, infant mortality. So it is, there is a correlation, whether it is closer upstream causally or further downstream, there is a strong correlation. And women, of course, in Cuba do have access to those services completely free of charge. And dental care is a very important part of their maternal care during pregnancy.
That's Dr. Kathy Tosas-Milligan. She's a epidemiologist at UIC. Andrea Palmer is also with us. She's chief of maternal and child health services division at IDPH. Andrea, as we've been hearing about infant mortality rates in some parts of Chicago and how it can be so different depending on where you live, I wanted to ask you, what does IDPH data look like for the rest of the state?
Actually, it really mirrors what's happening in Chicago, by that I mean that there are extreme disparities with respect to African-American women, non-Hispanic African-American women versus non-Hispanic white women. A lot of that we can attribute to social determinants of health, and because that disparity exists without respect to socioeconomic status or educational level.
And so when you say that, do you think it's more of a insurance question? Like, I wonder how much of it, when you say social determinants of health, is that what you mean?
No, it's actually tied a lot to generational trauma. It's tied to poverty. It's tied to the lack of availability of fresh foods. So, in other words, areas that are high crime, high poverty, where there are going to be mothers that are going to be in stressful situations. And so that's, I think, what is really tied to it.
And so when you say that, it sounds like you're saying that this is a problem not just in Chicago, but in places throughout Illinois where there are populations who are going through this.
Absolutely. We're seeing high disparities. But let me specify, it is directly correlated to race. So we're seeing that women, regardless of where they live in Chicago, in the state, African-American women have a 2 to almost 3 times as likely to lose their child in the first year of life than non-Hispanic white women. Mm-hmm. And that is a problem not only in Illinois, but throughout the country. And basically, through some of the, the Department of Public Health has a document called Illinois Infant Mortality Data Report that is going to be available on our website, hopefully by the end of this week. And it looks at infant mortality around the state, and it looks at some of the causes of it. And again, as I said, it is particularly prevalent for African American women without regard to socioeconomic status or education.
Dr. Batten, I wanted to bring you into this. You are at St. John's Children's Hospital in Springfield. How much, it's an interesting point that Dr. Tosas-Milligan made about primary care and sort of the Cuban model focusing on primary care and women. And I wonder if how much of that is part of the picture here when we're thinking about preventing these baby deaths.
Sure. I would certainly echo the statements and concerns expressed by the first two guests. Access to care is a big problem, not only on the south side of Chicago, but also throughout the state. I provide care mostly for a rural area, and getting to the physician, whether that be a half hour, an hour, 2 hours away, can be problematic. It can also be a problem here in Springfield, although the geographic distance that needs to be traveled is much shorter. some of our families struggle with transportation. If they don't have their own car, if they have limited funds, needing to take a bus across town with two other children to see the doctor can be a real challenge. So certainly access to care, I think, is a big part of it.
And Dr. Batten, to your mind, do you think that this problem is as much a rural problem as it is in some urban areas?
I think it's a big concern throughout the state, yes. I am not familiar enough with the data to sort of know the numbers, but certainly infant mortality is a concern whether you're on the south side of Chicago, whether you're in suburban Chicago, or whether you're downstate with us. I think we all can agree that the rates are higher than what we would like them to be, and certainly higher than what's been found in many other countries in the world and many other parts of the United States.
Dr. Tosas-Milligan, how much have you all found through your surveys, how much have you found that helps alleviate the problem of, it sounds like there's two issues here, what we're hearing from Dr. Batten and also from Andrea is about the whole issue of access to care. I wonder how the partnership you're working on has helped with that issue.
So I will tell you, we visited 50 homes in 9 days, 50 women of reproductive age from the Englewood community. And so with respect to access to care, there were definitely many of them that were not able to name, for example, their primary care provider. They, you know, even though we are with, the University of Illinois, the holds the 13 federally qualified health centers that are the Mile Square Health Centers, and one of which is in the Englewood community, which is one of the reasons why we chose that community, many of them didn't even know that we existed and that we were there. Part of it is because they were saying that we were in a location that was formerly a city clinic, right? And there was some stigma around what that city clinic did or et cetera. And many of them just, health-seeking behaviors, preventive health-seeking behaviors is not something that we necessarily promote and provide, unfortunately. And some of it is cultural. I'm Latina. The same thing happens in our Latino culture where you don't go to the doctor until you're sick. Same thing in the African-American community. And some of it is legitimately that, you know, there's either no access, no money, no time, right? Sometimes we have women that have multiple jobs, you know, that work in shifts, for example. And if you have someone who works at night, for example, where is she going to go to get her primary care? If, you know, we work 9 to 5. But I actually wanted to bring up and acknowledge something that Andrea Palmer mentioned around the concept of structural violence, because I didn't want that to be missed, which I think is really important. One thing that I think, and Andrea, please correct me if I'm wrong, is that, you know, African-American women are disproportionately affected by this problem regardless of their education and their economic status. In other words, if, you know, all else being equal, African-American women would still fare worse. And part of that is because of this concept of structural violence. In other words, the collective experiences, right? And, of course, the built environment, in a sense, where African-American women live and grow and thrive, that impacts, their health in general.
Yeah.
And that's the point.
Yeah, we just have about a minute left. So, Andrea, I want to just give you a chance to respond to that.
Absolutely. And Kathy, thank you for pointing that out. That's absolutely true. As a matter of fact, the data shows that for African-American women, for black non-Hispanic women who are born in other countries, their infant mortality rate tends to be mirroring that of non-Hispanic white or Hispanic women. But the next generation or two generations later, their infant mortality rate is, again, equal with that of African-Americans born in this country. So it is, you know, it's totally related to the structural racism, structural violence, poverty, social determinants of health, which we are looking at in the department. Another key cause of the infant mortality rate is prematurity for African-American women. And a lot of that has to do with, as Kathy and Dr. Batten mentioned, the availability and accessibility of medical care, prenatal care.
Yeah, so lots of issues here. Thank you, all of you, for raising some of them for us. And we'll look out for later in the week for IDPH's release of information about that Andrea Palmer mentioned. I want to thank Andrea Palmer. She's Maternal and Child Health Services Division Chief at the Illinois Department of Public Health. I want to thank Dr. Bo Batten as well for joining us, Chief of the Neonatology Division of Pediatrics at SIU School of Medicine in Springfield, and Kathy Tosis Milligan, an epidemiologist at UIC. Thank you, all of you, for being with me.
Thanks for having us.
For listening to The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Government in Illinois is unfortunately infamous for corruption, whether we're talking about our past governors or city officials. Nearly 2 years ago, a former Chicago City Council Inspector General launched a nonprofit called Project Six. Its mission to serve as an independent, nonpartisan watchdog dedicated to exposing corruption in government. But Project Six may not be as independent as it says it is. A recent investigation by ProPublica Illinois and the Chicago Sun-Times found that 98% of the nonprofit's funding in its first year came from the Illinois Policy Institute. That's a right-leaning organization that mainly backs conservative political causes. Its former CEO, if you may recall, was even Governor Rauner's chief of staff for some time. Mick Dumke has been reporting on this issue for ProPublica Illinois. He's on the line with us. Hey, Mick, welcome back to The 21st.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So before we get to this is how, why this is important and how you unraveled all of this, can I just ask why this organization is called Project Six? What's behind that name?
Well, I think it was a reference to a group of civic leaders who led the fight against Al Capone and that version of corruption during the Prohibition era. So I guess they were named something like the Secret Six or something like that at the time. And so the founder of Project Six apparently, you know, saw that as an inspiration for the kind of work that he wanted to do and wanted his group to do. So they took on the name Project Six.
And make that founder, Faisal Khan, is a name I think that is probably pretty well known inside of Chicago, but maybe not as much outside of Chicago. What should people know about him?
Well, I don't even know if he's that well-known inside of Chicago, to be honest with you, Nyla.
Maybe just journalists. Sorry, maybe a journalist. We know his name. Okay.
Yeah, and then people who really follow, like, you know, politics well into the weeds, I think. The backstory here, very quickly, is that a few years ago, there were some do-gooder-type aldermen who said, we need someone who oversees the city council and to make sure that they're there is a watchdog for the city council to keep an eye on potential corruption because probably as anybody inside Chicago or outside of Chicago for that matter knows, there have been quite a few aldermen through the years who've ended up in federal prison. So there's definitely that unfortunate history in the city council. As you noted, the same as in other government entities around the state. So anyway, there was a movement to make sure that the city council had a watchdog. There was some back and forth about whether the city's executive inspector general, the inspector general overlooks the rest of city agencies, should be that person. And through a compromise that didn't satisfy a lot of the people who initially were pushing for a city council watchdog, they created a new office called the Office of the Legislative Inspector General. Now, this is worthy of a full story unto itself, but basically, by creating this watchdog office, most of us who followed the story thought that it was set up to fail. They hired this guy, Faisal Khan, who had a background as a government investigator in New York State, and they brought him in. And, you know, I never questioned his earnestness or his intentions to try to, you know, really do his job and to investigate, you know, government, what he sees as government corruption. But the office was underfunded and it was thwarted by various aldermen. And after 4 years, the city council voted to phase it out. So the office was essentially closed down. The inspector general for the rest of the city of Chicago now has duties to oversee the city council as well. But Faisal Khan was out of a job with the city, and then he ended up forming this new organization, Project Six, which brings us to the current story.
And it's an interesting question, though, Mick, before we get to Project Six, just about these kind of watchdog groups, these government or corruption watchdog groups. And so I think when you think of groups like this, maybe the Better Government Association comes to mind, which is also a nonpartisan watchdog group. Is that the kind of thing that Project Six is kind of work Project Six is doing?
Well, I think that's how they presented themselves. And, you know, full disclosure, I work for a nonprofit. We are a journalism watchdog organization, ProPublica, based in New York, set up an Illinois office starting last summer. We got off the ground. But, you know, we're committed to journalism and we're staffed by veteran journalists. So I just wanted to be clear that there are a lot of different models for people trying to clean up government in different ways. And, you know, we're definitely nonpartisan and we're fact-driven, we're journalism-based. We are a journalism organization, period. But I just bring that up because you're right. There are other kinds of groups who either are doing watchdog work or claim to be doing watchdog work. Now, Project Six from the beginning has been, even Faisal would say, has been controversial because he had his critics coming out of his job at the city of Chicago. There were a lot of aldermen who thought that he either went after the wrong targets or was overzealous over and sweating this really small stuff or just was not very competent. And, you know, his response to that has been, since the time he was at the city and through his time at Project Six over the last couple of years, is that people are just criticizing him because they're bristling at the investigations. They're bristling at the facts that he's finding. You know, we think this is an interesting backdrop, especially since, you know, as he is fighting for government transparency and for good government and so forth, he has been reluctant to disclose who his own backers were. And, you know, we thought this was really important. So that brings us up to the current story where we were able to kind of do a little sleuthing and find out that, as you noted, the vast majority, almost all of his first year budget was funded by the Illinois Policy Institute, which is itself presents itself as a think tank and has a lot of respected followers and devotees, but you know, is also very closely aligned with a lot of conservative elected officials and the Republican Party in Illinois.
Yeah, can you explain a little bit more about the link between not just Project Six and the Illinois Policy Institute, but also Republican politics in the state of Illinois?
Well, Illinois Policy Institute had a very similar agenda to Bruce Rauner's going in. As a matter of fact, Governor Rauner, of course, you know, was elected with this pledge to bring a turnaround agenda, what he called a turnaround agenda to state government. I'm pretty sure that term came from the Illinois Policy Institute a number of years ago, long before Governor Rauner got into electoral politics as a candidate. The Illinois Policy Institute was going around the state holding what it called turnaround rallies. So they were on the same page in terms of ideologically and in terms of some policies about let's shrink the size of government, let's cut taxes, let's reduce regulations, let's try to diminish the power of public sector unions. So these are some of the commonalities they shared with Governor Rauner, who, before he was a candidate, his family foundation that he and his wife run donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to IPI. So right there you had an alignment between the two of them. There are also leaders of IPI who are also running political action committees. The most well-known is called Liberty Principles. It's a super PAC, which means they can basically spend unlimited amounts of money either for or against a candidate, and that super PAC is run by Dan Proft, who is a fairly well-known conservative radio talk show host, really smart guy, you know, really great conversationalist on the air, and he is also a political player. He runs the super PAC, and he also holds a position at the Illinois Policy Institute. And there's a lot of other connections, Nyla, but the bottom line is that while they are advocating for specific policy positions, there's also some overlap with electoral politics and campaign politics as well.
I'm talking with Mick Dumke. He's a reporter with ProPublica Illinois. We're talking about a new investigation out by ProPublica and the Chicago Sun-Times regarding the nonprofit Project Six. It's a watchdog group. This investigation found that 90% of the nonprofit's funding in its first year came from the Illinois Policy Institute. Mick's been connecting the dots here. And Mick, as you talk about this and sort of we're seeing these lines kind of blur, you made a distinction at the beginning about, for example, ProPublica and the journalism that does and that it's independent. But I think we've seen a lot of cases of these lines blurring, not just in Illinois, but across the country between groups that are media organizations, these watchdog groups. There are plenty of advocacy groups that are labeled nonpartisan, but maybe fall on one side of the political spectrum and maybe get funding from wealthy donors or other members of the political elite. I guess I'm wondering if you can explain why it matters that this organization turns out to be one of these groups.
Well, I think it matters because everyone who is in the business of advocating for politics or public policy, I mean, I think that the public wants to know who is backing you. Where does your money come from? Do you have a secret agenda? And, you know, identifying where the money's come from isn't the same as saying, you know, you're exactly in line with every single person who donated money to you. But it's the same principle of why there are laws at the state, you know, the local, state, and federal levels for campaign disclosures is, you know, the public wants to know, and we have a long history of this now, of basically demanding full disclosure. Now, in the case of nonprofits, this has become sort of a new avenue for a lot of political activists and advocacy groups, because you can set up a charitable organization and the rules aren't the same. I mean, actually, if you and I set up a political campaign or a political action committee, NYLA, we would have to disclose a lot more information about where our money's coming from than we would if we're setting up a charitable organization. So, for instance, most nonprofits, they do have to disclose if they're giving money to some other entity, but they don't have to say to the public who's giving them money. So it's a really interesting game. And so I think a lot of people who are listening are familiar with the Koch brothers, who became kind of notorious. They're, of course, the right-wing industrialists who have spent millions, perhaps billions of dollars at this point in time trying to reduce government regulations at local levels and at federal levels. And they're major political players around the country. And by the way, they're one of the funders of the Illinois Policy Institute. So I think seeing the way they operate and a lot of other groups who are operating either at the national level or the state level, people are just really interested in this. They think it's really significant. And there's this whole question of dark money. Where is all the money coming from? So we see this as just another one of those kinds of stories. We didn't really weigh in. It's not our place to weigh in on the quality of investigations or whether Faisal's doing the right thing or not. We let him speak for himself. We let his work speak for himself. We were just talking about who is paying for his group to operate, and we thought that it was important to note that.
And did he? What did he say? What was his response to, first of all, the work that you all did? Because it wasn't, when you're talking about transparency, the funding for this was not something that was also immediately apparent. This took a little bit of digging.
Yeah, we had to basically connect a few dots, as you said, by looking at tax returns, tax filings. And in order to retain your tax-exempt status as a charitable organization, you have to publicly disclose some, not all, but some of the tax filings you make to the federal government. So we were able to piece together this story basically by looking at the tax filings of a couple different groups and then, you know, kind of connecting the dots, doing the math, that sort of thing. When I initially called Faisal about it, he was pretty cagey, to be honest with you. He didn't want to talk about it. He actually denied that the Illinois Policy Institute was Project Six primary funder, even though I was looking at it right on the page. And then he called back and said, you know, he was very apologetic and said, look, I'm sorry I was overzealous. I'm really sensitive about this because we try to protect our funders. Most of our funders don't want to be known to the public because they fear reprisal because of this history of corruption and, you know, bare knuckle politics in Illinois. They're worried if their name gets out there that that could come back to hurt them. And that might be a credible argument, but, you know, I'm certainly, as a journalist, on the side of clarity and certainly on the side of full disclosure. And that's what his group purports to stand for as well. So we had to make that point.
All of this is in ProPublica, Illinois. It's on their website. All of this reporting that Mick did, as well as kind of there's an interesting backstory as well that you all have online, Mick, about how you were able to piece this together, more to your point about nonprofits and the transparency in funding and how different that is from, say, a PAC. We will tweet out all of those links. We'll have it at our website at 21stshow.org. We'll have it. Our Twitter handle is 21stshow. I want to thank Mick Dumke for being with us, sharing his reporting. Thanks, Mick.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Nyla. Good talking with you.
As I said, our website is where you can go for all of our latest information. If you want to send us an email, how to leave us a voicemail, how to follow us on social media, that's all at our website, as well as directions for Alexa. If you have NPR One enabled, you can have her play the 21st. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montecilio. Chris Stetson is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Scott Cameron's our executive editor. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.